This is your daily real estate syndication show. I'm your host, Whitney Sewell. Today, we've packed a number of shows together to give you some highlights. I know you're going to enjoy the show. Thank you for being with us today. Kelsey, welcome. I'm honored to get this time with you to interview you and really go through some tax questions, right? Questions I know I get asked all the time, and often I have to say, hey, I am not the one to be asking that question of, right? And so I have to look for obviously people like yourself, right? That are team members of ours that we partner with, trusted experts like you that have those skill sets. And in your case, it's tax, which we seem to, most of us need help in that world of tax. So happy to get to chat with you today. Welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
Kelsey, well, you know, often I get the question, what to look for on your K-1? Like, what does a K-1, like, why do I need a K-1? How do I read it? What does it mean for me? People ask all the time, you know, like, whoa, you know, it doesn't seem very complicated. However, I don't know how it affects my taxes.
Right. And it comes up so often. The number one thing is, and this really goes back to when you've initially filled out your investor sheets at the very beginning, when you get that K-1, is the name right? Is the entity right? Social Security, address, EIN, all of the things that are very, very simple. Look at those things first. Make sure that when you've filled out your investor sheets to initially sign up for the offering, make sure that you have put down the entity that you intended to be in there, whether it's your personal, whether it's an LLC. You know, make sure you've gotten tax advice if you need it before you do so that you have it in the right place. But the minute you get that K-1, we work just exhausting to ourselves to get these K-1s out in a timely fashion, both from the operator side and the accountant side. It's a dual effort. And when those go out, if you will just immediately look to see if the big stuff is right, because ultimately what happens is we'll get to September 14th, and we're to the last day before it can be filed, and we'll have changes still coming in on the partners. And so many of those things can be handled in the first 30 seconds that you open that K-1. So take a look at those things first. The other important items, contributions, of course. If you put in $50,000, make sure that down in the left-hand corner where it says contributions, that left-hand corner is your friend, bottom left. If you look at your contributions, make sure that matches in year one. If you got $10,000 in distributions in that year, make sure it says $10,000 of distributions. You're not expected to know what the net income or loss ultimately is, because obviously that goes through, you know, a ton of work and calculations. But the high level items of what did I put in, what did I get out, and is my name and social security number and address right? Those are all things that can really, really save a lot of time for just everybody. And then ultimately in a sale year, making sure that distribution lines up to what you got, because that cash is going to ultimately help figure your gain. So if it's wrong for some reason, ultimately you're going to have a surprise one way or another on your K-1 for that income. So it's not hard, but if you don't know what it is, then, you know, you don't know what you're looking for. But those are the high level items to take a look at.
Yeah, I know often we get people asking questions about, oh, wait a minute, that's not the entity I wanted on there, right? Or that's not the, you know, it's like, well, wait a minute, that's what we have, right? That's what you filled out on your subscription agreement, right? When you wanted to invest in the deal. And then it's a process, right? To get that changed or corrected or, you know, and if it's in their personal name or if it's in the wrong entity, right? They wanted an entity and not, it's a process and sometimes a legal process, right? To get that fixed.
Right. And it seems very easy of, well, I had it in, you know, Bob's name and I want it in Bob's LLC just for color, just to change that in the system and redistribute and repull all the K-1s and print it all again. All of the things that have to, the process on the back end of that, these tax returns now are 3,000 and 4,000 pages. So every time you change for one name, it's a 3,000 page process, you know, back to a file and zipped and sent out. So it's those things like that, that if we can catch them, in March and April versus September and October, it saves everybody a lot of time. And again, on the front end, the better you can do, the better off we all are.
Yeah, for sure. There's always, it'll just leaves more room for mistakes long term too, right? That's still on that
Right.
first document, because I can see us too, you know, where there's a question about somebody's return, or they even have a question about their K-1. We go back and look at that old subscription agreement, and it's like, oh yeah, it was in this entity, and oh wait a minute, they actually changed that, but maybe we didn't see that. You know, it's like, so could not agree with you more. And I think sometimes too, people, you know, they invest with their personal name, and then they get in some of these groups and figure out, well, wait a minute, I should have created an entity to start investing, and I want that in that entity instead. Well, it's not just as easy as changing the name, right?
Right. And it can be so long as everyone knows, but it's basically anytime you want to make a change, you should have those changes to the operators and, you know, through your investor portal or however those need to be made, have that done by, you know, at the latest January 1st, January 15th of the current year to where it happens before we start tax returns and before we're, you know, off in the midst of doing them. That makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Anything else about a K-1, Kelsey, that an LP or passive investor should know about or think through, you know, when they receive it, or, you know, I don't know, any other questions that maybe you get from LPs?
Yeah, it's generally the only other questions are kind of on the, it's always in the sale year of why do I have all this income? It doesn't ever quite register, you know, that because you got cash, you're going to have income. And the two are always, they think of it more of a, well, I just got my capital back. Well, you did, but you got that capital back because we sold a property and have a gain. So the two always go hand in hand. And again, just having some tax advice somewhere along the way, you know, letting an accountant know if your personal CPA, letting them know, hey, I sold this property to where it's not a surprise on the back end. And you can get pretty close by following the cash you received.
You know, Kelsey, the K-1s, and it's a process, right? Our team has just, my goodness, I feel like we've been running through the ringer a few years, you know, trying to improve that process. And we're trying to provide better service to our investors, right? Well, many of them, you know, are very concerned, right? That if they can't file by the first deadline, right? And so I just wonder, you know, what are your thoughts behind that concern, right? Should they be concerned if they're filing 3 or 4 weeks later, right? You know, if it's even 8 weeks, you know, after that deadline, or, you know, what are your thoughts behind that?
I just don't see it as an issue. I know it's always a thing to rush to get these out by April 1st so that people can file by April 15th. And I do understand if you just have one K-1 and that's the only thing that's holding up your return, that's frustrating. But from an IRS standpoint, I've been at this. This is my 19th tax season. I've never seen any correlation between the two. I know there's some, you know, older school that maybe you got audited more if you filed in late September, October. But I just don't think that, you know, May and June filings make any difference to April 15th. Obviously you want to have your taxes paid in so that you don't have penalties and things, but the extension itself, it doesn't hurt you.
Well, you know, who can actually deduct these real estate losses, right? I think there's confusion there often. Who can use those? Who can't?
That is probably one of the number one questions I get. A lot of times it's new investors. It's their first real estate investment. And this d doesn't only pertain to real estate, but it's anything that is passive. So I give you $50,000 of my money. And then essentially, other than checking in to make sure it's going okay and getting my distributions every year, I don't do anything, right? I invest my money for you to put it to work. Then we sell a property and I get, you know, some percentage of that sale and hopefully that's a gain and we move on. So by nature, I'm passive in that investment. So what the IRS says is, you know, nice try. If you have a passive investment, you can always pick up passive income. They're never, you know, worried about that. But you cannot take a passive loss unless you have passive income to offset it. And so what I find the most often is that someone goes out and they read these offerings, or they read, you know, blogs or wherever they get their news source, and they see invest 50,000 and get 35,000 of depreciation expense in year one. You're going to get this big loss and save all these taxes. And that's where everyone stops reading. And what really happens is, assuming that's in a bubble and you just have that 1K1, I don't have 10 other investments that I'm not active in, that loss doesn't go anywhere. It sits there. You get to keep it. It's yours, but you can't deduct it in the first year because you're not active. In order to be active, you'd have to have at least 500 hours in any one activity. Looking for investments doesn't count. So truly out there pounding the pavement, part of it, or more than anyone else. So in an LP deal, a normal real estate deal, that's just not going to happen. However, all of that loss carries forward. And so when we were talking earlier of, you know, we had gain on a sale, and so I got distributions of $100,000, but I have a $100,000 gain. So I normally have, you know, somewhere in the $30,000 tax range. Instead, now, because I was passive, I've got all these old losses. If I hold the property, say 3 years, year one and two losses are hanging out there. They didn't help me, right? Nothing happened. But now in year three, I sell it and all those old losses collapse down and help me out against that gain. So if you had taken it in the past, then you'd be totally exposed on the gain. But by not taking it and it hangs there, then the two net come together, and that's where you get your benefit. So you get it, but it's not going to offset your wages from your doctor's office, your wages from, you know, wherever you may work. That passive loss is just not going to offset that. And I think there's just a lot of confusion around that particular little nuance that we get really excited about the depreciation losses, but don't stop to make sure it all fits into your particular situation.
Yeah, I know, especially early on, I remember being confused about that, especially the more investors I talk to as well, you know, and they have a W-2 and that's what they're hoping for, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what they're hoping
absolutely.
For.
Absolutely.
Yeah, wouldn't we all, right? But it's the you know, you have to remember, you have to have the passive investment or the passive income, right? To have the passive losses. But even the active piece, you mentioned to be considered active, 500 hours. And that's a pretty significant amount of hours.
Right. It's a lot. And, you know, you can get there a lot easier if, say, you own a rental property. So you know, buy a couple of duplexes, then it's a little easier to get to that active participation. And you maybe take some of those losses there. But they're going to find a way to take them away if they can. Like, that's the way I always try to tell everyone and think about it, is if it sounds too good or too easy, it probably is. And so just always keep in mind that, you know, if you're putting up 50 grand, that you understand that there's kind of a deferred portion of that. So you're going to get your investment back and you're going to get to take losses or offset that gain, but it might not be a right up front gratification on that tax savings.
Yeah. So if you are, and then maybe this is too specific, but you know, if you're a W-2 employee or doctor or whatever, it may be beneficial to own a duplex so you have some active hours. Is that in real estate?
It helps a little bit, but it still won't get you there with your LP investments.
Yeah.
It would just maybe get you some losses, you know, somewhere else. It might help you out. But these LP investments, for the most part, if you're a W-2 employee, you're just not going to get there. So it's more about where it comes into play is, say I'm in a year where I had my first LP investment and now we're into that sale year and I don't have enough losses to offset that gain. And I've got a bunch of ordinary income and it's sitting out there and I'm exposed. That's when you can time it and maybe go into another investment. And because you have passive income from a sale, now you might get to offset with some of those new losses. So you start into a pattern, if you're willing to do it, you start into a pattern of kind of chasing deals is what you end up with, to where if I know I've got a big exposure of tax in this year, well, now is a good time to go invest in another property, get some of those losses to help offset. You're kind of pushing it down the road, but as long as you're willing and able to put up the money, that's how you can kind of use those losses.
Wow. Any other tips or thoughts around that, or the way people have done that, or just any confusion around that from LPs?
Right. I mean, I think the big thing now is the bang has gone down a little bit because bonus depreciation is phasing down. So, you know, up through 2022, we were taking 100% bonus, doing cost segregation studies. It was easy. You were getting, you know, a good 30% of every property as 100% bonus and deducting it. 2023 comes along, that's 80%. Now we've started 2024, we're down to 60. Now, you know, we're all patiently or impatiently waiting for something to happen and that get changed again. But right now we're at 60%. And so you're really going to have to start to be careful. I think you're going to see people maybe being a little more deliberate about when they invest and how they invest, knowing that the dollars are a little smaller now. Again, it's all timing, right? You get it. It's just a matter of when.
As you know, many of our investors, even as they grow in their investing, right? It was different when maybe they just had a salary, you know, income or W-2, and then they make their first passive investment and they make a few more. Oftentimes, you know, I get questions like, well, Whitney, when did you hire a personal accountant, right? Or somebody to do your taxes versus you're doing your own thing, or and I just, you know, want you to be able to answer that question for them, because I'm sure you get the same question often.
I do. And I think every situation is a little bit different. You know, if you have a W-2 and a 1099 and, you know, a couple of kids or deductions, then, you know, going online and doing your own taxes, that's exactly what I would do. When you start to invest and you're going to get K-1s, if any of the things surrounding passive losses or real estate, or, you know, what happens when you sell, if any of those things are new and confusing, if that's probably a sign to talk to someone and get some help. The other thing that I've noticed over the years is the investors that email investor relations a lot. They have a lot of questions or about, you know, how these things come up or how they've come onto their K-1. If you're catching yourself doing that a lot, that probably means you need to go get someone. And the reason I say that is not because we ever mind answering questions, but we always have this little bit of caution that we're not giving tax advice out without knowing an entire situation, because there's always an if or an or an and that you may not know about. So we have to be a little bit careful too. But I will tell you that if people come to me, LPs, you know, just anyone in general, if they come to me, have me look at a tax return, and I look and I say, hey, there's just one K-1 and you may have two questions a year, I'm more than happy to answer those two questions rather than charge them a bunch for a tax return that they could otherwise just get online and do themselves. And so I would say, reach out to someone, get some help, but at the same time, don't pay a whole bunch of money if it's just not quite that time yet.
Yeah, I know for myself, it was a growing process, right? You know, as my taxes became much more complicated, you know, even early, you know, in the real estate investing, it was just obvious I needed some help. You know, I mean, I just needed, right. I had more questions, like you said, you know, more and more questions as I'm doing more things outside of a salaried position. And I didn't know the answers. And it was pretty quick. I'm like, okay, I need somebody else to do this for me.
Right. And I think the other one that triggers it immediately is, you know, if you're a Texas resident, but you invest in a Colorado property, or, you know, the other way around, anytime you're outside your own state and comfort zone, that gets a little bit tricky. Generally, it's going to be time to, you know, check in with a professional and kind of make sure that you're going about it the right way, or you don't miss something and get a bunch of notices or deduct something you shouldn't and land with an audit, because that's ultimately going to cost you three times what it was to just pay someone in the first place.
And I get that question as well often around, should I be filing taxes in other states since I'm investing in properties in those other states? Well, what, how would you respond?
And the answer is generally always. And the reason is, again, I'm a Texas resident, but I have invested in a property in Colorado. If I don't file in those the first year when there's a loss, then when I sell that property and I now owe tax in the state of Colorado, Colorado doesn't know anything about those losses that happened 2 years ago. So when we talk about, getting to take losses against potentially against gain in a later year, that falls out for those state returns if you never filed. So even though it may cost you a little more, if you have a $20,000 Colorado loss, that's now going to save you, $2,000-$3,000 of tax, and you paid $500 for a tax return. Well, it was worth it.
How can they learn more about you?
Right. If you ever have a question or want to reach out, you can either email me, and Whitney, maybe you can add my email and my contact information. The easiest way to get a hold of me is email. I'll get back to you as soon as I can. We're about to be super busy, so I may be a little behind the next couple of months, but we are ramping up and hiring up, and so I'm always glad to try to help field questions and help out wherever I can.
Thank you for being with us again today. I hope that you have learned a lot from the show. Don't forget to like and subscribe. I hope you're telling your friends about the Real Estate Syndication Show and how they can also build wealth in real estate. You can also go to lifebridgecapital.com and start investing today.